Ladies and gentlemen, I've handed around an article from the Wall Street Journal, January 2nd, by the author Joseph Epstein. Perhaps you've read Joseph Epstein. He's a very fine writer, writes frequently in commentary. And Epstein has this article on Milton Steinberg's book, As a Driven Leaf, which is a classic. It was really probably the best of his books, I think. His book on Judaism was the most popular, probably, but I don't think it's going to stand the test of time. I think it's seen its best days. But this is a very good article. Realize that Milton Steinberg really used Elisha ben Avuya Acher as a springboard for what he wanted to write. And if this is, it's a novel. It's not based on a lot of sources, because there aren't a lot of sources, but that wouldn't stop someone like Steinberg, who, you know, just took off and saw in Elisha ben Avuya, a figure that he could create the tensions of tradition and modernity. And that was, of course, the tension that Jews were living with in most of the 20th century. You'll see there, somewhere he makes reference here to Chaim Potok, who says he read As a Driven Leaf, and it opened up the world to him. And of course, Chaim Potok wrote exactly on the same subject. I mean, it's history and tradition, or modernity and tradition. Honestly, I think that those issues have passed. Those are not the burning issues today. There is much more, well, I've just been, it's no longer, the issues are not that, without going into what in fact they are. But I thought you might find this interesting if you didn't see it before, and if it should influence you to read As a Driven Leaf, you could do worse things. I read it years ago, and I'm sure it's probably available at a good price. Eric, this was for you. Just spoke about Milton Steinberg's As a Driven Leaf, which is an article about it. Now, let's turn to page 15A3. Continue our study. Remember last time we learned why he was called Acher when he went to visit the prostitute and pulled out radishes on the Sabbath, and she originally thought, "You're Elisha ben Avuya, aren't you?" And he pulled out the radishes, and she said, "Oh no, you're Acher, somebody else." And that was, according to our text here, the way in which he got the name Acher, the other one. That's not what you will usually hear, by the way. First of all, you don't usually hear the Talmud. You don't hear prostitutes quoted too much in the general life, in the Talmudic world. Usually, Acher is understood to be the name given to Elisha ben Avuya because he was an apostate. And he was so terrible that you don't want to speak the name. And that's usually what you will hear. But as I say, it's not what we read. Now, I think it's important to keep in mind what we are reading, and I'm trying to keep in context what we are reading. Professor Lieberman, in his comments in the Tosefta, Lieberman was my teacher, a great Talmudist. Lieberman's student, by the way, I haven't mentioned to you. Lieberman had a close student, Rabbi Dov Slotnick. Gutzlotnik retired from the faculty of the seminary, moved to Israel, lived in Jerusalem, and died a few months ago. So I paid a shiva call on Mrs. Slotnik in Jerusalem, and it was like another world. It's a world that's gone. It's a world that's gone. The world of Liberman is gone. He's a world of these traditionalists who were scientific scholars. You have Orthodox Jews today who are scientific scholars. You didn't have them in those days. Instead, you had people like Lieberman and Slotnik. It's another world. So Lieberman, in his commentary to the Tosefta, and the Tosefta is contemporaneous with the Mishnah. It's Tosefta means added. Sometimes a Tosefta, like a Musaf, added service. He speculates on another reason why he was called Acher. I have not seen anyone say this other than Lieberman. So since you have a student of Lieberman teaching you, I want you to know what Lieberman had to say. Lieberman speculates that Acher comes from the Hebrew Achor. And Achor, because it comes from the Hebrew phrase Chazor le'achorcha, turn around backwards, which frequently, when it is used in Talmudic Hebrew, means that something unusual, secret, you're going into a time machine, and you're going to then read something that couldn't normally happen. Okay? So Lieberman speculates that when he went into Pardes, that was thank you. That was Achor. He turned around backwards. He went into that secret place. And that's why he speculates that it was called Acher, and actually it should be Achor, not Acher. Eventually it was turned into Acher because of the pejorative nature of the word Acher, and you'll see, maybe we'll get to it tonight. It's used even in terms of animals, Acher. The pig is sometimes referred to as an Acher because it's so repulsive, the pig. The idea of being with a pig is just so impossible to deal with that the pig is not called a pig, but an Acher. Okay? So eventually so Lieberman speculates that eventually that's what happened to Achor. And it originally meant the mystical experience that he had gone through.
It's the context.
Yeah. So always learn from Lieberman. Lieberman was a great, great, great scholar. You'll excuse me. I am, as you can see, in the middle of what Jay gave me. But Jay and I were the beneficiaries of this thing going around. But you're a week ahead of me. So we'll see how far I can get tonight. At some point, my voice may.
Well, you decide when to end if you are not feeling.
That may happen. So I am forewarning you. But I still have enough voice so that I really didn't want to ask you to come closer because you need that like a whole head.
I recommend the facial steamer.
Facial steamer. I'll listen to the good doctor.
Remarkably effective and totally benign.
Okay. That's what I like. I like things that are totally benign and remarkably effective. Actually, the story of my life. Okay. Okay, let's go on. We're on 15A3, if I am not mistaken. Sha'al acher et Rabbi Meir, ve'achar she'yatzal et tabut ra'ah. Acher asked Rabbi Meir after he had gone out l'tarbut ra'ah. Now that's an important phrase, tarbut ra'ah. Tarbut literally is culture. Ra'ah is evil, wicked, culture, and it always refers to someone who has become part of that other culture had left the Jewish fold and in fact gone into another culture. So here's another dimension of Acher. It's not just a theological problem. It really goes beyond that. It is a cultural problem. Obviously, he was drawn into the surrounding culture. And remember, at his time was the time of the post-Hadrianic persecutions, the time of the persecutions immediately following the Hadrianic persecutions. There was no rabbinic love for Rome, to say the least. Although, having said that, still the rabbis lived in a Roman culture. I mean, realize that the culture of the Eastern Mediterranean was a Greek Greco-Roman culture. It was Hellenistic culture. It was Hellenistic culture. There may have been a specific religious dimension to it, but all the other aspects of it, the bathhouses, the way people dressed, there's so many aspects to culture. Don't think that the rabbis of the Talmud looked like they lived in Borough Park or in Williamsburg. They looked, in all likelihood, like Romans, like educated Romans of the period.
We were just in Sapporo.
Oh, you were in Sapporo. Perfect example. I was going to bring up Sapporo, but you brought it up first. If you go to Sapporo, I mean, you can see this. It's an extraordinary sight to see. You see a Roman amphitheater here, 2 minutes away, is where Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lived. And the great rabbis...
What? And lived very well.
Yeah. And they obviously lived down the block from each other. So obviously they were constantly in contact with one another. They spoke the same language. They all spoke Greek. And realized that the eastern part of the empire was not a Latin-speaking part of the empire. It was a Greek-speaking empire. So they all spoke Greek. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi spoke Greek with great fluency. They said that in his house, nothing else would be permitted other than to hear good Greek. And so there is something, however, when you are living in an alien culture, but to them it's not an alien culture. It's their culture. Okay, it's not really an alien culture. But at a certain point, you can be Yotzei LeTarbut Ra'ah. Okay? You can become a part of the evil culture. It's not the way you dress. It's not the language you speak. There is some tipping point at which you become that culture and you're no longer your own culture. Now, we're moving into this stage here in American Jewish life. The Israelis are actually in a different place. In American Jewish life, we're with that. We're not really sure what the limits are here because we're very assimilated. But on the other hand, we have found that as assimilated as we are, it's actually possible to maintain a Jewish culture. But we're not sure about it. We're not sure if it's possible. We're not sure how to do it, what the ingredients are, what kind of education you need, whether that education will work. We're going to see this. Some of you sitting here, you have children in the day schools. Children went through the day schools. The more progressive type of day school, which is our Shekhtar school. Fascinating. I told them that right at the beginning they should do a study. I wanted two studies to be done. I wanted a study to be done at the Heschel school. Follow these kids. Get some sociologists in and start right. They should have started this 30 years ago. When this was an issue, and then when we started in the schools. Second thing with the Heschel School. Just we need to have a longitudinal study of to see 20 and 30 years from now what happens to the kids.
Studies were done, Kev Ma has done that study.
Okay.
And to great positive effect.
Okay. This is very important stuff.
I can show you the study.
I guess I did read some of the Rama stuff because this was a big issue on the internet. In response to the Pew study, which basically said American Jewry is finished. Then Jack Wertheimer wrote, and it based part of it on Ramah, on the studies done at Camp Ramah, and the power of the camping experience. But that's something we're only going to know. You know, we need this this kind of information, because we're actually beginning to produce, I think, we're beginning to produce a group of highly assimilated people who are still maintaining a significant degree of commitment. That's not something that was anticipated. It's not true, or it may be true, I don't really know. In the Orthodox world, it's more complicated, actually. Certain symbols in the Orthodox world are extremely important. As they tend to be in religious communities, the wearing of the kippah has a certain significance in that world. And I don't judge it. And maybe they're right and we're wrong with it, but we're both right. I don't know. We're only going to know this in time. In the Haredi world, they have the same issues, and they've created a whole series of symbols of clothing, which they feel is absolutely necessary for the maintenance of identity. And far be it for me to say that they're wrong. They may be right. They may be right. We're only going to know this over time. I don't know any way that we will know it otherwise. But here, I'm just trying to flesh out this notion of tarbut ra'ah. Tarbut ra'ah. When you realize that the rabbis lived in the Hellenistic culture, and we shouldn't think that they weren't a part of it, and Tzipori is absolutely the best example. Absolutely.
So I think in my lifetime in this country, in fact, assimilation was much greater in the late 50s into the early 60s. That's when you had many Jews changing their names. There was a very conscious attempt to decrease the identity of Judaism in the workplace for a lot of reasons. And it was part of the melting pot philosophy. I'm being a very bad amateur sociologist, I would say, interestingly enough, that the thing that changed this was the Black Power movement. Because the Black Power movement put ethnicity as a positive virtue rather than the assimilation model. And you know, that's Moynihan Beyond the Melting Glazer and Moynihan Beyond the
exactly.
Melting Pot and the stew rather than the melting pot, and the reassertion of ethnic identity started to become a major trend, which frankly hasn't stopped to this moment in the United States. So I think that it's interesting to watch that this can ebb and flow. It's not a one-way street by any means.
I'm not sure there's a religious component to this, though. People might identify as Jewish, but not belong to a synagogue, not get an education, and over time, that
can disappear almost a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean,
slippery slope.
Identity and
well, the other
and
issue.
The two very different issues.
The other issue I would just throw in, which I think is a more recent issue than that of the 60s and the 70s, is the relative disappearance of anti-Semitism for the American Jewish community. There was a time in the 50s and the 60s, Jews felt, whatever it was, but it was, I think, really caused by the outside. The outside is something that's very important in maintaining the Jewish identity. It hasn't totally disappeared, but it's a lot of it is gone. A lot of it is gone. The acceptability of intermarriage among Christians, let alone Jews, is a relatively new phenomenon of, let's say, the last 15 years or so. And it's only building energy, so it's a little hard to anticipate where that's going.
I think, aside from the Black Power movement, I think what empowered the American Jewish community, especially among the young adults, was the Six-Day War. And that had, I think, a very powerful effect on publicly expressing pride in being Jewish, whether that meant that you observed anything was something else. But I think that was, in addition to the many other things that were boiling around in the in America during those years. I think that that had an impact. But I want to ask about Elisha Ben Abuya. Where did he fit into the community on that spectrum? Did he completely separate himself, or was he living in the midst of the community?
Let's go on. Mm-hmm. Let's go on, because you're going to see that. And we realize what we've just read here. Sha'al Acher. Acher asked Rabbi Meir after he went out to Tarbut Ra'ah. The first thing you have to notice in this is that he's having a conversation with Rabbi Meir. In effect, this is going to be a lacha conversation with Rabbi Meir, who is his student. So that, given what we read last time, I would think that we would assume that he would have no students. The last thing he would have. And the students are very well aware of what has gone on and the way in which the rabbinic community has responded to him. And yet here, Acher, now who's the teacher, asks Rabbi Meir a question. Now it's a flipping of roles. But still there is a relationship there, and the relationship did not cease. Okay? Well, let's look at what he asks. Amar Lei, Acher said to Rabbi Meir, my dichti. So he's going to ask a question about a scriptural verse. What is the meaning of the verse? Gam et zel umat ze asa Elohim. God has made the one as well as the other. Okay, what is the meaning of the verse? God has made ze l'umat ze. Now the word l'umat means, it's hard, it's a hard Hebrew word, it can mean a lot of things. This as opposed to that, this in contrast to that, this next to that, something like that, one of those things. So he says to Rabbi Meir, what is the meaning of it? Amar Rabbi Meir, Amar lo. He says to him, "Kol masha baraha kadosh baruch hu barak negdo." Everything that the Holy One, blessed be, he created something opposite it. That's why I would translate "kenegdo." It doesn't have to be that. "Kenegdo," like you say, the Torah says that
it doesn't mean negative.
Right, it doesn't mean negative. I was just going to quote that, where the Torah says that Eve was created as an Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate. No, Kenegdo, how would you translate
it? Could be negative, but this is supportive.
It's a helpmate for him, probably we would translate Kenegdo. Okay, but that's the Hebrew there, is Ezer Kenegdo. So this is a hard phrase to translate.
Is it different?
Something like that. Something like that, something like that. Amar lo, kol masha baraka dosh baruch hu baraka nigdo. Bara harim bara gevaot. Now here he fleshes it out. He created mountains, and he created hills. Bara yamim, he created seas. Bara naharot, and he created rivers. So in other words, this is what Rabbi Meir means, that there are things that are similar but different that are all part of the divine creation. Amar lo, Acher said to him, Rabbi Akiva, Rabcha, lo amar kach. Rabbi Akiva, your rabbi, didn't say that. Deals with his student. He says, your rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, didn't say that. Ella, barat tzadikim barar sha'im. He created the righteous and he created the wicked. Baragan Eden, baragaino. He created paradise and he created hell. Kol echad v'echad yeshlo shnei chalakim. Each person has two portions. Echad b'gan Eden, echad b'geinom. One portion in paradise and one portion in Gehenna. Zacha tzadik, if a person, a righteous person, merits it, natal chalko b'chilek chaviro b'gan Eden, he takes his own place and his neighbor's place in paradise. Nidchayev rasha, when a wicked person is deemed to be guilty, this is now, we're talking about the ultimate disposition after death. Okay, after death. Natal chalko, natal chalek chavero b'geinom. He takes his portion and his neighbor's portion in Gehenna. In other words, probably half the people going up there, half the people going down there. And every time one goes down there, he vacates a place upstairs. So whoever's going upstairs, he gets a chance to take both of them. Now, just imagine this teaching now. Look at the interplay between these two rabbis. There's a third rabbi brought in, which was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Meir's understanding of the phrase, the biblical phrase, is, the way I would describe it, is sweet. It's a really very beautiful thing. It's an artistic idea that in the divine creation there are seas and there are rivers. I just came from the winter art antique show that was the last few hours down on Park Avenue here, the Park Avenue Armory. Some of the, Usher Durand, I think, who has a seascape there. Gorgeous, gorgeous seascapes. And, you know, some of the American painters were just fascinated with the Hudson River or the Atlantic Ocean. These East Coast painters. One that I looked at, I'm not sure who was Durand, so one of his contemporaries, did Barnegat, New Jersey, doing the seascapes on the Jersey coast. And these great painters just have a softness for the beauty, this extraordinary beauty in the seascape, in the riverscape. And that's what I see Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is giving that kind of an answer to the question. But Acher brings a theologically such a disturbing answer, which is put in the mouth of Rabbi Akiva. And of course, since we know already what we read last week, it's as if he's playing out again his own guilt. He's playing out his own guilt, realizing that his portion is the portion of Gehenna. That is where he's going. Okay? So that it's as if he sets up Rabbi Meir, and Meir is so sweet in his response, and then he says, "No, I'm going to hell. I want you to know that." don't you forget it. And again, I think that we as the readers, I at least as a reader, I don't know about you, tremendous sympathy for Acher. You know, it's a pitiful kind of thing to read, that he changes the subject and sort of plays on the cruelty of the divine disposition of his own final future. Okay. Now let's go on.
Those paintings are religious paintings.
Oh, they're all. These are all a bunch of transcendentalists, these right. guys. So
they're all inspired by religious paintings.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They're not just a seascape. They're a seascape
absolutely.
In the glory of God.
In the 19th century, it's true in the writers, and it's true in the painters of the 19th century. They are all one kind or another of transcendentalists. And they have a tremendous religious sensitivity. They may not like religious institutions so much, but they're a bunch of mystics. One is more mystical than the other. There's just a variety of different kinds of mysticism that were popular. I mean, if it's Walt Whitman, I mean, they're all, it's just, it's a, it's, they're all these are contemporaries.
Some of them do have, you know, little churches and spires in there. And then it's moving away from that image later in the century to this is like God's temple.
Yeah.
Nature
is God's temple.
The outdoor temple.
You read Moby Dick. Moby Dick is one of the most religious books I ever read. And not all the critics understand it because American critics today don't know anything about religion. They're just stupid. They're not educated. But if you know anything about religion, you realize that Melville was an extraordinarily educated religious person. And it's playing itself out. All of these ideas, these Gnostic ideas that we mentioned last time, what do you think that whale is doing there? I mean, there's a certain notion of the power of evil. The power of evil. And Ahab. All this is biblical stuff. This is all biblical stuff. These guys are really incredible. As I said, generally speaking, nobody knows this anymore, except a few historians, but even the historians just are not educated. They don't know the Bible. If you don't know the Bible, you can't possibly understand what these people were dealing with. Okay, let's go on. Yes?
When Achaia comes with the rejoinder and calls Rabbi Akiva saying, forget what you're thinking. Is he reflecting his idea of God's judgment of him as because of his apostasy going to him? Or is he reflecting the rejection or condemnation by his colleagues?
It's a good question. The answer is, of course, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, of course, I don't know. And I also don't know that God has delivered a judgment. Now, I would underline that. Because we remember, last week we saw the phrase, the Nishma Bat Kol, or something like that. A voice from heaven comes. Bat Kol. Bat Kol is a ruse, a rabbinic ruse. And the bat kol, to some, to the average mind, appears as if it's a divine voice and an authoritative voice. But in the Talmud, that's not what happens with the bat kol. In the famous story of Baba Metzia, where you have the argument with the rabbis, and one rabbi says this, and they say, he says, if I'm right, let the river turn around and go backwards. And so on. There it goes through several different steps. Finally, the last one is, there came a bat kol from heaven. And the bat kol said, Rabbi Eliezer is right. To which the rabbis then said, we don't listen to a bat kol. Okay? Now, if the bat kol were really divine, you'd have to listen to the bat kol. I mean,
no,
it would have authority.
The argument that the rabbi don't want to listen to God because he's saying, you put us here, we are now making
exactly.
So
exactly.
It's the same.
Correct. And that's the crucial point here. So I'm just saying that the bat kol, even though the bat kol said, the bat kol said that you're going to hell, don't take that as too much because, first of all, it doesn't come from God. It's influential. There's no doubt. In the story that I'm quoting here, everybody says, oh, that's good proof. And then, of course, it's just the Betin comes and says, we don't listen to it. Papa called, we don't listen to it. Which, when you read it, of course, it's funny because it's not what we expect. We expect that the divine voice would be authoritative. And the divine voice is rejected. So keep that in mind here, even though you've got a bat kol.
Even if they hear a bat kol, nobody knows what God's intention is. So
absolutely. Absolutely, you're right.
So you can only react to the social environment. And where he is, I don't know, he wasn't in Cherem or anything, but he was excluded from the community. They didn't even call him by name.
Well, we're going to see how excluded he was. Because first thing, realize he's got an ongoing relationship with his student, Rabbi Meir. He's quoting Rabbi Akiva. Okay? So this may be excluded, but this is not what I would call, as you had said, the cherem. He's not a cherem. He obviously
his
life
was good.
His life was good. Okay. Let's keep going. Yeah, psychologically, he seems to be in Gehenna. That's how he is psychologically. Amar Rav Mesharshia. My kra'a. Oh, let's keep going. On top of the right side of the page. Because there's a second story now of it structured exactly the same way. Sha'al acher et Rabbi Meir li'achar shi'atza betarbut ra'a. Exactly the same way. The words are exactly the same words as we just read. Right? My dichtiv. What is written when the scriptures say, Lo ya'archenu zahav uzechuchit utmurata kli pas. But as for wisdom, mankind does not know its worth. Gold and glass cannot approximate it, nor can its exchange be in golden articles. Okay? It's in the Proverbs, I believe, if I remember. Is that right? No, it's from Job. From Job. Amarlo, Rabbi Meir says to him, Elu divrei Torah. This is referring to the words of the Torah. Shekashim liknotam hichli zahav, that they are as dear to acquire as a gold object. In other words, they're very expensive, meaning that they're so precious. They're precious things to acquire, like gold. Uchlipas v'nolchim la'abdan kichli zechuchit, but they're as easy to lose as a glass object. That is to say, you could just break it. You could just break a glass object without any effort at all. So the words of the Torah are dear to acquire, but cheap to lose. They're very easy to lose. Easily broken. Okay? V'nodnin le'abdan kichli zuchuchi. They are as easy to lose as glass vessels. Amarlo, Acher says to Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Akiva, Rabcha lo amakach. Your rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, didn't say that. Right? Exactly the same structure. Ella, ma kli zahav uchli zechuchit, af al pi shenishberu yesh lahem takana. But rather, he taught that just as there is a remedy for gold and glass vessels when they break, namely, they can be put together again. There's a way to put them. You can put them in high heat, and you can recycle them. These are recyclable things. Af Talmid Chacham. So too a Torah scholar. A Torah scholar can also be recycled if he breaks. Imagine, what does he say? You know, if I'm a broken scholar, I too have a takana. Right? I too could be repaired. Af al pisha sarach yesh lo takana. Even though he has sarach, he's become putrid. He has said things that are intolerable. Yesh lo takana. He can be repaired. Amar lo, Rabbi Meir said to him, Af ata chazor becha. Nu, go back. Go back. So Rabbi Meir senses an opening. There is an opening to tell him to do tshuva, to repent. Alright, so he says, go back. Amar lo, Acher says to him, Kvar shamati me'achareya paragod. I have already heard from behind the curtain, Shuvu banim shovavim. Return, O ye wayward children, chutz me'acher, with the exception of Acher. Oh, what? The literature is incredible. It's such incredible literature.
Is that the same sort of going back, as you said, Achor was before?
Exactly. This is the example of Achor is Achara paragot. Paragot is a curtain. Curtain, or it may be a curtain. Modern Hebrew. It's fascinating. I went to an exhibit.
What we cover the Torah.
No, that's Parochat. That's the Parochat.
No, but the whole, what do you call it? Aron Torah, you put Pargod in front of it.
No. Well, I don't know what you mean in front of it. Let me just give you an example, and maybe we're talking about the same thing. Modern Hebrew. I went to an exhibit at the Israel Museum. How long am I here? About 3 months ago or so, just before we came back. And it was an exhibit of Japanese screens. So they had gotten a collection in the Israel Museum of all places from a collector in New Orleans. There's a Jew in New Orleans who collected Japanese screens. Unbelievable, fantastic collection of Japanese screens. And what happened was, this is the bracha in every klala. This is the blessing in every curse. What happened to New Orleans? The hurricane. So a hurricane came to New Orleans, and the guy's whole house began to crumble. This wealthy guy who must have had a place, you know, near the water, where it was very beautiful. So he had this enormous world-class collection. He had to get rid of the screens. What's he going to do with the screens? So he said, I got to get rid of this fast. So he knew somebody in the Israel Museum. So the Israel Museum took all of this guy's screens. Jerusalem is very dry. He needed a dry climate for his screens. So the lady who's leading the tour I was on, the lady says, I asked her a question. I said, well, after going back to New Orleans, he fixed this up his house. So she says, we're trying very hard to keep the screens here because we think it would be a wonderful contribution to our collection. You better believe it would be a wonderful contribution to the collection. So why am I telling you this?
I saw them?
They're fantastic.
It's
world-class stuff. Really, absolutely gorgeous. So why do I tell you all of this? How do you say Japanese screen in Hebrew? Pargod Yapani. Pargod Yapani. A pargod is a screen. It's a screen. So here, okay, when he goes, Ahara Pargod, there, we've always translated it, we Americans have always translated this as behind the curtain. There's actually something more physically present in Hebrew, which the Israelis, I think, have used the term because they're sensitive to the subtleties of the language, the way we're not as sensitive. And that's what a pagod means in modern Hebrew. So is that what you're referring to? Yeah, good. You've got screens in front of an ark, too.
Do you know if the Wizard of Oz is meant to be a religious symbol?
Oh, I'm sure it is. No question about it. It's all...
But it turns out to be nothing.
Well, all of that's a religious... It's a fable. It's a myth. It's a religious myth. Yeah. Okay. Going on. Tanu Rabbanan. A rabbi's thought. Maaseh b'acher. Once upon a time it happened with Acher. I always translate Maaseh B as once upon a time. The introduction to an Agadah. Shaya Rochev al Hasus b'Shabbat. He was riding a horse on Shabbat. Now, you're not allowed to do that. Came on a horse on Shabbat. Okay? Well, listen to look what happens next. This is Acher. He's riding a horse on Shabbat. V'haya Rabbi Meir mehalech acharav l'lmod Torah mipiv. And Rabbi Meir was walking behind him in order to learn Torah from his mouth. Just incredible stuff. Incredible. Who would believe it? Okay? He's walking behind the donkey here. Okay? And in order to learn, this guy is transgressing the Sabbath. And still he's a fount of knowledge. Incredible. Okay? Amar lo, Acher says to Rabbi Meir, Meir chazor li acharecha. Same language now as in the previous Agadah, but has a different meaning. Chazor li acharecha, turn around and go backwards. Okay? Eshekvar shi'arti bi'ikvei susi. Because I have already calculated through the paces of my horse. Ad kan chum Shabbat. this is as far as it is permissible to go with the Sabbath, Tchum Shabbat. How do you translate that?
Limit, Shabbat limit.
The Shabbat limits. It's on the Shabbat, there's a limit to how far you can walk. 2,000
a month.
2,000 a month.
He's pushing the envelope. He's at the edge of the envelope.
So he's telling Rabbi Meir,
right.
He's going beyond with his horse.
Right.
He says, Rabbi Meir, it's time for you to turn back.
Him.
He's protecting Rabbi Meir. He knows exactly what he's doing. Amar lo, Rabbi Meir says to him, Af ata chazor becha. Alright? He picks up, you too go back. Alright, Rabbi Meir is sensitive, he's right. Alright, don't tell me to go back. It's the same law, it's for you too. You too go back. Amar lo acher says to him, V'lo kvar amati lacha, don't you remember what I said to you the last time? Kvar shamati me'achareya paragod, I already heard on the other side of the screen. Shuv u'banim shovavim, return a wayward sons, chutz me'acher. Okay, with the exception of acher. Takfe alei levei midrasha. Rabbi Meir grabbed him and pulled him to the house of study. Alright, Rabbi Meir pulls him into the house of study. Amar lei liyanuka. Acher says to a young boy, Psok li psukach, tell me the verse that you're studying. Amar lo, the boy says to Acher, Ein shalom amar Hashem l'arsha'im. There is no peace for the wicked. It's not a good beginning. Okay. Ay le'levek nishta acharite. Rabbi Meir takes him to another synagogue. Amar le'liyanuka. He says to a boy, study. Psok li psukach. Tell me what verse you're reading. Amar lo, the boy says to him, Ki im techabsi banete v'tarbi lach borit, even if you are to wash with nitre and much soap, nichtam avonech lifanai, your iniquity remains stained before me. This guy's got no muzzle.
Bad luck.
Okay, bad luck. Ay leilevek nishta acharite. He takes him, Rabbi Meir takes him to yet another synagogue.
Like, the Dickens Christmas
Carol. It was terrific. Amar Lei. Amar Lei says to him, Liyanuka, to a young boy, Psok li psukach, recite your verse for me. Amar Lo, Va'at shadud matasi, O you, O plundered one, what will you do? Kiltil bishi shani kita adi ade zahav. Even if you don a golden ornament, if you wear scarlet, tikti krei bapuch einayich. If you paint your eyes with mascara, lashav tityapi. It is for nothing that you have dressed yourself up. In other words, you are a sinner, and you might dress yourself as if you are not a sinner. You still remain a sinner. I lay levek nishta acharite. He took him to yet another one. Rabbi Meir is very persistent. He's a persistent guy. Kul hu pasku leka hai gavna. Oh no, sorry, he says this. Ad da aile litlesar bek nishta. Until he had taken him to 13 different synagogues. He took him to 13 different synagogues. Kulhu pasku leka av gavna. And all the boys recited exactly verses of the same kind. Levatra amar lei. Finally, at the last one, the acher says, Psok li psukach. Give me a verse. Amar lei, the boy says to him, Vilarasha amar Elohim malach alesaper chukai. But to the wicked, God said, to what purpose do you recount my decrees? Hahu Yanuka Hava Megamgem Bilishne. That particular boy stuttered. Right? He was a stutterer. And I just read it, he says, Villa Rasha Amar, La Rasha. Okay? So the boy stuttered. The Ishtama Kamadi Amarle, and Acher heard it as if he had said to him, Ule Isha, Le Elisha Amar. Not Le Rasha Amar, but Le Elisha Amar. Because the guy said, Le Elisha Amar. Right, he was stuttering. Right, so that's what he said. So Elisha heard as if it were directed directly at him. Ika di Amre. There are those who say, Sakina hava bahade v'kar'e. Achar had a knife with him and dismembered something. Either the boy or some of the commentators say that it was the page that he was reading from. He took a knife and he cut up the page. He was so filled with rage, that he pulled the page apart. V'shadred l'tlesar b'knishta, and he sent it to the other 12 synagogues. Okay. This is Acher. The Ikad Yamre, and there are those who say, I have biyade sakina. There are those who say, had he had a knife in his hand, he would have done this. So there are two different traditions about what it was. But the point is, just it is incredible, like that it's so pitiful. There's such a sense of the pity of the person. That he can't stand being in this position. On the one hand, he's committed to it. And on the other hand, he can't stand it. I mean, that's the kind of dissonance that Milton Steinberg loved. It was the reality of this in one person to live with that kind of inconsolable dissonance. There's no way to really work this stuff out. And that's the person you're dealing with.
On the one hand, there's this personal turmoil, apparently. But on the other hand, here is this sweet student who has tried on a couple of occasions to urge him to go back. You know, it's not as though he doesn't have someone reminding him or trying. So I think he has committed to this path. And you remember when you said the saplings that were cut and that you said, we'll come back to this? So when you said the saplings, I thought that this was maybe particularly egregious because the saplings are new growth of a new generation that were cut down before they had a chance to grow. And I think it's interesting in connection to the fact that this is a student who was younger, Rabbi Meir, who he is doing this very bad example with. He insists on riding even though he's talking to this young man that's walking. I mean, he could have gotten off for a minute. He was really emphatic in making a bad example. And they're also going to young students reading this, too. So there is something about the sapling, about the, I think, the modeling for and undermining the next generation.
Very nice, and it's all true. What follows in the Gemara, I'm going to do a little skipping now. What follows in the Gemara is Rabbi Meir, Acher eventually dies, and Rabbi Meir says, I hope that he first goes to hell, to Gehenna. That's actually a positive step, because the rabbinic notion of Gehenna is one of purification, right? Because once you've spent your time there, you get purified, and then you have all eternity to spend in paradise. Okay, so that's what Rabbi Meir is hoping to do, and Rabbi Meir eventually dies, and they see in the Rabbi Meir's grave a pillar of smoke goes up from Nebuchadnezzar and realize that what Rabbi Meir has done is that that's the pillar of smoke of Acher, who's now down again. So once he got there, he was able to take the soul and bring it down to Gehenna. And then Rabbi Yochanan eventually says, I'm going to bring him up to paradise, which of course is what eventually will happen. Okay. Rabbi Meir is then asked, the Gemara then talks about Rabbi Meir, how was it that you could continue to be his student? The Gemara then goes into several different theories about how that was possible. And the one that is repeated is where Rabbi Meir says, I ate the fruit and I spit out the pit. Okay? I ate the fruit and I spit out the pit. He does it in two different stories that have the same point to them, which again is really quite extraordinary, that there is room to allow for the possibility that even the heretic can be a master teacher, and that the responsibility is then on the student to know what to spit out. And that's not a simple thing to do, but it's something that Rabbi Meir was capable of doing. He was able to do that.
So I have two comments. One is reminds me of Schoenberg. There was a wonderful exhibit at the Jewish Museum a couple of years about him, and his compulsion to follow the atonal music was because the logic of its development was absolutely intellectually compelling. But he knew that everybody would hate the music to listen to. And so he was tortured by having to fulfill what was this absolutely linear, in his mind, linear development to reflect the progress of the discipline, while understanding that he was not going to make any friends by doing any of this. But it's that same sort of tension.
Correct.
Seems to play out. The second comment is, since I get to be involved with a lot of mentorship and definitions of mentorship, and people who are very concerned about mentorship of junior physician scientists, etc. So just make one or two comments about what I tell young people. So mentor wasn't a human being. Mentor was a goddess in the form of a human. So
Greek mythology.
In Greek mythology and the Odyssey. So I always say, you will never find a perfect mentor, because the reality is, a real mentor in that notion is really divine, and we don't have any divine people. We're only human. So
modest.
I can predict that your mentor will not be perfect, but you have to understand that being mentored is not a passive process. It's an active process in which you have to identify those elements in the people that you see, that you admire. And I always talk about negative mentoring. You also have to see the things in people that you see that you despise, mm-hmm. and make sure you are not ever going to do any of that. So that you have to create this composite. Now, for people my age, I tell them about Mr. Potato Head, and how when I grew up, you had Mr. Potato Head, and you took the ears of this one and the eyes of that one, you put it together into the face that you wanted, and that's really the message. And I think that this is a wonderful example.
That's therapy too, basically.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's therapy.
In therapy, it's a similar idea.
Perfect.
Yeah, so don't throw out the good with just
right.
Because
you don't throw out the whole truth.
Right.
Wait, hold on just a second. I want to go a little bit further. Hold on. because I'm petering out, so I want to just give you another source which is relevant to the story of Acher. There's another place in the Talmud where Acher appears, and I want to make you aware of this. This is at the end of the Tractate of Kiddushin. Kiddushin, which is about marriage and the laws of how to conduct a proper marriage. And the last chapter of Kiddushin deals with a totally unrelated issue, except insofar as Kiddushin, we studied 1 year Kiddushin, well, we studied a few years. That's where you have the laws of honoring father and mother. Okay? So at the end of the chapter, there's a concept that comes up in the laws of honor thy father and thy mother. And that is the concept, the Torah doesn't say just honor thy father and thy mother. The Torah says honor thy father and thy mother so that your days shall be good and you shall live a long time. Okay, that's what the Torah says. So, in the Gemara in Kiddushin, let me see if I can find it. The Gemara raises a problem. It says, Haresha Amar Lo Aviv. Right? What if a person's father says to him, Aleila Bira Vahaveli Gozalot, climb up on the tower and fetch me some young birds? Because the law of Shiluach HaKen, which is the law where if you're going to take young birds, you have to let the mother go first, okay? So your father says to you, climb up there to the nest and get me some young birds. Va'alala bira, the son climbed up to the tower. V'shilach et ha'en, and he drove the mother bird away. I say, follows the Torah exactly. And he is observing the law of honoring his father. His father told him to do that. Natal et habanim, and he takes the offspring. Uvachaziraton nafal vamet. And when he was coming back, he falls and he dies. Falls off the ladder and he dies. Okay? Hecham tovat yamav shelzeh. Where is the goodness of his days that the Torah promised him that he's supposed to have? Ve'echan arichut yamav shelzeh. Where are his length of days? Right? Fantastic. And this is not some liberal commentary to the Torah. This is the Talmud. The Talmud discusses this. Okay? Right? So this is a problem that the Talmud raises. And then it has to deal with possible solutions to this problem. One possible solution, for example, is that when you're doing the mitzvah, it's one thing, but when you're coming back from the mitzvah, you no longer have divine protection. That's why we always say, when you're a messenger, when you go to Israel, people give you money to give tzedakah. Okay? And the problem is coming home. Okay?
You need someone on the other side.
So you need someone on the other side who gives you tzedakah to come. This, I have my people there, by the way. I see my friend, my neighbor from across the street. He always comes and says, Oh, tzvi, ata, anosei mahar, bo, etan notenacha. He says, you know, I'll give you some money. So, but that's one possibility. It's not a good solution, because after all, the Torah says, the person who does these things should get that gift as a reward. Okay? So, then we come up with several other possibilities here. The Gemara finally comes up with a wonderful thought, and that is, the Gemara answers, Sulam Ra'ua Hava. It was a broken ladder. The ladder that the guy climbed up on was a broken ladder. The Kviya Hezekah, where it was bound to collapse. Every time you put yourself in a situation which is bound to collapse, we cannot be dependent on a miracle. So in other words, if you use a faulty ladder, you can't say just because you're observing the law of a mitzvah that you're going to get a reward for it. You have to use a good ladder. There's a very profound truth here. Very profound truth.
That's it. You got to check the ladder before you climb up. But you can't.
You better believe it. You shouldn't climb up a ladder unless you know it's going to be a good ladder.
Okay. Substitute for quality control.
Okay.
You could be smarter and send a messenger to do the job.
So this is the Gemara answer. But Gemara goes on. Gemara then says, "The Acher Mayhu." Then it brings up Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. What was the thing that set him off? Now, we read about him going behind the Baragos, you know, that he had this mystical experience, and that is where he went wrong. Here the Gemara says the following, Ki hai gavna chaza, hura adavar bidiyu kazeh. He saw exactly this happen. In other words, he saw a righteous person who should have been rewarded for his righteousness, in fact, die an early death. And it was that experience that undermined his faith. That undermined his faith. Okay? The Ikad the Amre, and there are those who say, the Chutz Bita Maturgaman Chaza, that he saw the tongue of Chutzpit, the interpreter. Do you remember who Chutzpit the interpreter is? He was one of the ten martyrs. And he saw that the Romans had taken out his tongue, which was the way they punished Chutzpit the Maturgaman. Yeah, we talk about this on Yom Kippur. So, in other words, it was, here the Gemara is saying it is either that the righteous suffer in their daily lives, which is the first possibility, or that the righteous suffer in Jewish life. That in fact, the tzaddikim, the pious people, Chutzpita Maturgaman, he saw the Romans take out his tongue. It's exactly the same question that Elie Wiesel would raise. It's Elie Wiesel's question. As if he reads Night, this is the background of Night. This book is a great book of Night. And I just wanted you to see this before we leave Acher. We've seen him in such a highly theological context. Realize that the Gemaran Kiddushin really speculates in an entirely different way, in ways that I think are perhaps much closer to us. That we truly understand, which are really problematic for the religious life, and that is when the righteous suffer. In either of these two categories that we mentioned. Any comments here?
May I ask this question?
We're first one and then two.
The relation of Abuya, Elisha ben Abuya, and Jesus. I don't know if they lived exactly in the same time.
Elisha ben Abuya lived considerably after Jesus.
After
Jesus.
Do you know if Jesus had any influence on him?
There are those, if you read the modern scholarly literature on Elisha ben Abuya, depending upon the scholarly vogue, everybody says that's what influenced Elisha ben Abuya. Some have said it's Christianity, that in fact it was percolating Christianity of the second century. We're now dealing with the second half of the second century. Okay? Or, I shouldn't say the second half, rather the middle of the second century, a little bit before, because the Adrianic persecutions are 132. Okay? So you're dealing with that period of time, that it could be Christianity, that it could be the Roman persecutions, that it could be Gnosticism, which is what we had done. That it could be none of these, that really he was simply somebody that he was a Sadducee. A lot of rabbinic historiography of the last 100 years has tried to interpret a lot of what's in the Talmud as the arguments between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. My teacher, the chancellor of the seminary, Rabbi Louis Finkelstein, wrote a 2-volume book called The Pharisees. And in a lot of rabbinic material, if you read the Jewish Encyclopedia, interprets it, Elisha ben Abuya was a Sadducee. And his ideas are consistent with those of the Sadducees. So I'm just saying that what has happened is that generally you find that it's whatever is in vogue as heresy, Elisha ben Abuya becomes that one. I, of course, have told you what's really true. Tried to go behind the curtain.
Because the way I see it through the story is that he's going forward, and Rabbi Meir, who is the Jewish, stands there. Like, the Jews missed the train, Jesus came, you know. So, I mean, all the stories are showing that he's progressing, and Rabbi Meir is a little bit behind him on everything.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's why I thought, is that really...
Can't say anything more. Yes,
Robert. To go back to the story of the Pardes, since one of the gentlemen died, the other went mad or whatever, so when Rabbi Akiva made his comment marvel, he must say, my mind, he must have been speaking to Elisha ben Abuya because he was the only one available.
Well, so if that was the right time sequence.
Your comments.
I mean, it could be they all went into, we don't really know.
Pardon me?
We don't know because we don't know whether the story in the Talmud is indicative of the fact that they all sort of were holding hands together, they went into a room together, or they were colleagues who were somehow having a contemporaneous experience. Or are we reading a later literary creation that really puts different stories and different personalities together in one story? You know, these are four people who were four interesting characters who experimented with mysticism. And the story that we read makes it seem as if they were all doing it together. We don't really know.
Maybe Elisha ben Abuya was a mystic. Maybe he became wrapped up in ideas that were...
Well,
not
that I have no doubt about. I mean, that's what I'm arguing to some extent, that he's really a mystic, and that what that meant was, in light of the few details we have about his experience, is that that is also connected with mystic dualism. Hmm. All right? Because he sees Metatron. You weren't here last week. I think we read about Metatron. He sees Metatron, and the complicated thing about the Metatron story, there are two sides to it. One is that Metatron was, remember, he was sitting and should have been standing. Right? And then Acher posits the possibility that there is a second god. Okay? And that second god is called Metatron. So that's one way of reading the Metatron story. The other is that Metatron is giving merits to Jews. He is tipping the scales in terms of their ultimate fate by increasing the merits of individuals when they reach the Day of Judgment. Okay? So, in light of the story that I just read to you, on the problem of the righteous and the suffering of the righteous, there's an aspect of what Metatron is doing that could, if what we've just read in Kedushin is the story that's really the story of what's eating at Elisha ben Abuya, that this is reminding him of the unjustness of divine reward and punishment.
So, is if it's directing it towards Elisha ben Avuya? Because you could say, why did he say, Rabbi Akiva, oh, whatever it is, Altamar Mayim Mayim? Mm-hmm. Why didn't he just say Altamar Mayim? Because today we are learning that Elisha ben Avuya asked Rabbi Meir, the student, about the duality of Zeh v'Zeh. What is it? So something in that question must have not appealed to Rabbi Akiva. We didn't tell him, don't say Mayim, if he was speaking. Mm-hmm. He said, don't say Mayim Mayim. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. But there's something very interesting. The whole thing is pretty difficult to comprehend. And imagine, was fascinating when you read from a manuscript, I don't remember what section of the
particularly
interesting after 1,500 years to suddenly get an insight. But how many people could have said, oh, because in this manuscript they wrote, they have no idea. They must have had no idea. It's very provocative. It's thought provoking.
Or maybe just common knowledge.
That's very, very, for me, very intrusive into the emotional component of studying. I once brought up the life of Guil da Costa, a similar personality, mm-hmm. in the sense that he thought he was a Jew, but didn't fit with what was acceptable to be Jewish to that environment. The other question I have is, when Mordechai Kaplan was teaching at the seminary, at the same time people, where I come from, reconstructed terrible. So he had a very devoted following of students and colleagues. At the same time, he was not conforming to, I was a member for 20-something years at the
Society of
Judaism, should excuse the name. It's pretty weird. Rabbi Kaplan had a very good handle on what he had in mind. Most people did. I thought that this one's rabbi knew that it was raining Erev Yom Kippur. The next morning was sunny and beautiful. And as it usually isn't. And he makes the comment, well, I'm glad that the God that none of us believes in was looked kindly on us and gave us a nice. So, you know, some people could laugh it off, but most people don't find that very funny. So what was Mordechai Kaplan's situation?
That's a long story.
That was a long question.
All right. I'm glad we had the opportunity to study together again, my friends. This is the last of our sessions for this year. And I do hope that you continue studying more and more donuts.
Thank you very much.
I went back and watched it with my daughter, which wanted to give her an experience with me.